Welcome to the Sports Law Biz Podcast, dedicated to helping people better understand the law and business of sports. I'm your host, Peter Ott, and we've got a lot to talk about here today, so why don't we just jump in? Hello, this is Peter Ott with the Sports Law Biz Podcast. I'm here today with Pat Kisak, a law student at Boston College Law School. Pat is the author of a Law Review article published in the September 2016 issue of the Boston College Law Review entitled, Out of Service, Does Service Time Manipulation Violate Major League Baseball's Collective Bargaining Agreement? So to start off, Pat, can you introduce yourself, give us a little bit of your background about you so we can better get to know you?
Sure. First, Peter, thanks for having me on the podcast. I'm a big fan. It's great to be here. As you said, my name is Pat Kisak. I'm currently a 3L at BC Law. I grew up just outside of Philadelphia in a town called Hatboro, and I think it was really my exposure to Philadelphia sports that got me started in becoming passionate about sports, the industry, and law as well. I moved up to Boston, another great sports town, in 2009 to start college at BC, and I've been here ever since. And I actually got my start working in sports before that, in 2007. I was working as a score reporter for a high school football website in Pennsylvania, and I was helping out with some of their Friday night radio broadcasts too. But while I was at BC, I was lucky enough to continue that kind of work as a play-by-play broadcaster for the BC football, men's and women's basketball, men's and women's hockey, and baseball teams on WZBC, our radio station out there. As a law student, I worked with the BC Sports and Entertainment Law Society, and we ran our first reboot of the Boston College Sports Law Symposium last spring, so that was great. And finally, this last summer, I worked at the firm of Paul Weiss, Rifkind, Wharton, and Garrison, and I had the opportunity there to work on a number of sports-related matters. As I'm sure you know, Paul Weiss is home of Ted Wells and a number of other litigators who work pretty frequently with the NFL, NBA, and FIFA, and a bunch of other sports leagues. So I'm hoping to continue to have some opportunities to work in sports there as well.
Okay, yeah, no, that sounds like a great opportunity that you have there. Paul Weiss is a great firm, and yeah, certainly lots of sports-related work there. So yeah, no, thanks for that background. And so in law school, you wrote this article about service time. It's not a typical legal article, you know, about due process or something like that. How did that kind of come about?
Yes, it's true. So when we were choosing our note topics, I was going through a bunch of different things, and I looked at some of those kind of typical due process arguments, but I wanted something, considering this is going to be like a 40-page article, something that I would be really interested in. And it was just around that time that the baseball season was coming up again. I was considering a couple things. I looked into the possibility of talking about an international draft or possibly other things to come up in the CBA, but I really focused on this issue with Chris Bryant, because it really was exploding kind of not just in the sports law world, but in mainstream sports media as well.
Okay. Well, yeah, no, I think it's an interesting thing. It's something you hear about a little bit, you know, on ESPN or whatever. But to get a more in-depth analysis in a law review article is a good treatment. So yeah, let's talk a little bit about it. For people who are perhaps unfamiliar with how years are counted and service time works in Major League Baseball, can you give us a brief summary of how that works?
Of course. Well, for some background, free agency and service time are pretty modern concepts in professional baseball. Not modern in the past few years, but I mean, for the first 100 years of professional baseball, there was no such thing as free agency or service time. So after the 1976 CBA, they instituted this system so that players could actually become free agents. And so it's measured in this measurement called service time, which is actually measured in service days that add up to service years. But until a player gets up to 3 years of MLB experience measured in service time, the club can basically pay the player whatever it wants, subject to the minimum salary rules. After those 3 years, or sometimes it can be less than 3 years for a Super 2 designation, the players can file for salary arbitration, and they get to have an independent arbiter decide on what the salary they deserve is. The real big line is after 6 years of service time, when a player can file for free agency. So the particularity about the system is that it's measured in days on a major league roster, and 172 days are a full year of service time. And there are usually about 185 days in a full MLB season, so there are more than the number of days that constitute a full year of service time in that season. So if a team really plays its cards right, and decides the right time to promote a player to the majors, it can actually prevent that player from accruing a full year of service time in his first season, and that has the effect of keeping him shy of the 6 full years of service time at the end of his 6th major league season, which keeps him on the hook for another 7th year before he can actually file for free agency. If the team really wants to see a financial benefit, too, it can wait even later into the season, usually into kind of mid-July or June, so that it can delay the player's ability to file for salary arbitration as well.
Yeah, no, and I think this whole the whole way that salaries work in Major League Baseball is a really interesting concept in and of itself. And you see, you know, for the first 3 years, generally people tend to make around the minimum salary, and then they go into this arbitration where there's some negotiation there, and then afterwards, you know, that's when you see the big free agent contracts after 6 years. And so, you know, obviously the salary goes up once there's some bargaining with arbitration, and then it potentially can be huge when it comes to free agency. And so teams, as your article talks about, can kind of finagle a way to minimize the number of days that people are on major league rosters and try and keep them under, you know, salary control for additional years. And that's kind of the issue here. The what happened with Chris Bryant is that the Cubs wanted to have him on their team and contribute to their team, but they delayed his entry into being on a major league roster in order to kind of keep him an additional year at the cheaper salary. Is that correct?
Yeah, of course. And this it's definitely not a new thing. It's the service time manipulation in this kind of way that the Cubs did with Chris Bryant. It happened before with George Springer, and it's happened before with other players, and it will continue to happen. It's just that this specific instance, he was performing so well before the Cubs decided not to put him on the team that it really came out, and there was an outcrying of support in favor of Chris Bryant, whereas we didn't really see that before.
Right, because normally it's in the baseball team's interest to promote somebody who's playing really well to the major league roster because they want their team to do well. But I guess in this situation, it was surprising because he was playing so well, and it was clear that they wanted him on the team. They just waited until a specific time where it would be safe to promote him.
Yeah, and it's also a little bit different from those other instances, especially the George Springer one with the Astros, in that the Cubs in this situation weren't a team that was kind of middling or at the bottom of their division. They had just gone through massive offseason spending, big free agent acquisitions, and they were kind of saying, this is our year and this is our final piece. And Chris Bryant was seen as kind of the savior that could take the Cubs over the top and get to the World Series. And of course, now, as we know, in 2015, they won 97 games. They won even more games last year, and they finally did win the World Series with the help of the newly crowned NL MVP, Chris Bryant.
Yeah, so I think it makes sense that this situation. It's certainly different than other jobs and even other pro sports. You don't see lawyers, you know, having new incoming lawyers work at as paralegals for a certain amount of time and then only promoting them so they don't have to pay them, you know, the first year salary or something like that. And this whole situation only exists because of the collective bargaining agreement between Major League Baseball and the Players Association. And so they've agreed to this setup that counts the days a certain way and things like that. And the fact that the Cubs were able to follow the rules and use this timing mechanism to try and maintain a lower salary for Chris Bryant, it seems to be within the plain language of the CBA. Is that correct, or is there a violation of the rules that were agreed between the parties explicitly?
Yeah, so one of the big problems in this situation is that there's no part of the CBA that ever actually says you have to promote a player once he's fully developed, or that you can't use the service time system to your own benefit. And that's why it's really better argued under kind of this old tool for contract interpretation that's been around for about 200 years now, in the implied obligation of good faith and fair dealing.
Okay. So talk to us a little bit about that. I mean, I think people who've been to law school are familiar with this implied obligation, but some listeners of this podcast might not be.
Yeah, of course. So one of the first things you learn about really in your 1L first year contracts class is the implied obligation of good faith. And like I said, it's been around for about 200 years. It's used for post-execution contract interpretation. And it's defined in a lot of different ways by a lot of different scholars. But the gist is that parties to a contract should act in good faith to abide by the party's original intents as they expressed them when they made the contract. So in trying to find violations of this implied obligation of good faith, you have to look at the original contract. In this case, it would be the collective bargaining agreement. Define what all of the reasonable expectations of each of the parties were at the time the contract was created, and then look to see if a party that had discretion in the contract used that discretion to defy expectations or to avoid having to do certain things that the other party would have reasonably expected as part of the contract. Now, in this case, I make the argument in my note, you can combine the competitive nature of baseball itself completely outside of the CBA with the salary arbitration and the free agency provisions of the CBA that talk about service time. And then the players and the union have an argument that they have a reasonable expectation that clubs assign players to a major league roster once the club believes that those players have reached the full development in the minor league and they can help the team compete for a championship. And the Bryant case, like I was saying, is kind of the pinnacle and the perfect storm for an implied obligation of good faith argument, because the Cubs dedicated themselves to the offseason improvement and were finally ready to chase the pennant once Bryant's breakout was complete and he was still sent to the minors.
And it is important to note that this implied obligation of good faith is something that is a cornerstone of New York and U.S. law. You know, I'm a practicing attorney and drafting contracts, and this is something that's part of every negotiation, and it's not necessarily required in other countries or other jurisdictions, and so it is. You know, I'm not going to say unique to U.S. law, but it is an important part of U.S. law. And so, you know, anything that's implied, an implied obligation, can be difficult to prove that the other party was failing to exercise this obligation. But it is something that parties are supposed to have and working towards a fair and equitable result. And so, it's certainly possible to see how the Players Association or Chris Bryant himself could make an argument that doing this was a violation of that.
Yeah, and I think you make a good point too, in that because it is an implied obligation and it's really unique to the U.S., it can be something that's hard to prove. And in this case, it's almost a little bit harder to prove as well, because you take the dispute out of the U.S. court land and you put it in this weird grievance arbitration land that the MLB and the MLBPA have negotiated for in their contract, which is mandatory. So Chris Bryant can't just go and sue the MLB in a court of law and say they violated the CBA and then discuss the implied obligation of good faith. He actually has to explain it to an impartial arbitrator that's chosen, or a panel of arbitrators depending on the panel, to show that this implied obligation was violated. And arbitration land is kind of the Wild West in terms of law, when the arbitrators don't really have to look at any legal precedent. Of course, it'll be persuasive to the arbitrator when he's looking at it, but he's not really having to abide by any rules of procedure that would go on in federal courts. And even though the federal courts can review the arbitrator's decision, as we saw in the Deflategate case between Tom Brady and the NFL, our courts are extremely deferential to arbitration awards. And the doctrine at this point is, I think, one of my favorite legal quotes, which is, unless the arbitrator is dispensing with his own brand of industrial justice, the arbitration decision stands.
There's definitely a lot of deference to these arbitrators. And I don't know if you know, are these baseball arbitrators, I believe they're selected by both the league and the Players Association. Do you know if they're baseball specific, if they kind of have experience in the realm, or are these just arbitrators that are general arbitration people?
So it goes back and forth, and the union and the MLB get to kind of negotiate with each other on who will be the arbitrator, and then if they can't decide on any, then they go to an American Association of Arbitrators that are completely unrelated to baseball. So I would imagine in most of these situations, they kind of default to the same few arbitrators that have dealt with MLB arbitration awards before, so they kind of know what they're getting themselves into. But if they can't agree on an arbitrator one side or the other, they actually do take a list and then just start taking names off of the list until they have one left.
Okay, well, yeah, great. So... I guess before we get too far into the weeds here, so you've identified this issue that there's this potential for manipulation, which could be harmful to the earnings of Major League Baseball players. You know, what are some alternatives to this current situation, the current way that it's set up as far as service time?
So In my note, I identified a couple of different models. One of the interesting ones was made by Mike Petrello from FanGraphs, which is a great website, and they do a lot in terms of kind of proposing these new ideas for service time. And under Petrello's model, he would reduce the number of days required for a service year to 100 and change the system to more of a qualified season than a service year. And so you would have to accrue 100 days in a single season to have a service year instead of adding up the days from different seasons to reach a plateau. And you'd still have kind of a 1,000 service day limit just in case, so you can't control a player for 10 years. But it would reduce some of the risk of a Bryant situation because a team like the Cubs wouldn't wait for 80 days into a season to bring Chris Bryant up if they actually wanted to compete. There's also a model that's proposed by Ken Rosenthal from Fox Sports, another interesting one that suggests that the current system would stay the same, but that there'd be a give and take. And if a club would put a rookie on the major league roster on opening day, then the team would be granted a seventh year of control in exchange for the player being able to file for salary arbitration after only 2 years. This one, as I said, is interesting and it makes sense in Bryant's case, but it doesn't really address manipulation for salary arbitration problem. And it's also problematic for cases where players actually go back to the minors for any period of time. Another one that's been around for a long time was an age model where you tie free agency directly to a player's age, because age is kind of the one thing that can't be manipulated by either the player or the team. But no matter how this is formulated, it's still problematic because it really negatively impacts players who are drafted young, quickly make it to a major league roster, and then kind of have to toil away until they reach, say, age 27. But in the opposite scenario, a player takes a really long time to develop, and then the eligibility age negatively impacts the team because the team puts in kind of significant work to mold that prospect throughout their time. The final models are, I call them promotional review models. Scott Boras, agent extraordinaire, he represents Chris Bryant. He makes a case for a model where a player can file a formal claim saying that the player should be placed on the major league club's roster. This one is kind of a ridiculous idea. I mean, it infringes directly on the club's front office and says an independent panel of scouts reviews the player and says the team has to put the player on the roster. But the players' union kind of suggests a different one, where there's a post-promotion review model, and players have a certain amount of time to file a grievance alleging that their promotions intended to circumvent the CBA and manipulate service time after they're actually promoted to the major leagues.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's interesting hearing all these different models. You know, I think anytime you have a system where you have to draw a line, and that line affects, you know, how much money somebody makes, no matter where you draw that line, it's going to affect somebody, right? And so, you know, I guess the question is whether we as a society or people involved in Major League Baseball want that line to be people like Chris Bryant or, you know, maybe it's somebody farther down the line or something. But each model seems to have pluses and minuses, but clearly somebody's going to be affected in a negative way under any of these systems, I think.
Oh, definitely. And Ken Rosenthal wrote a really long piece on Fox Sports about the service time model, where he discussed a lot of different models, including his. And in his interviews of executives and union reps and players as well, I think one union rep or executive came to him and said, if you have an idea, please tell us, because we have no idea what to do. We have no idea how to solve this problem without hurting one side.
That kind of reminds me of another thing, a conversation that I had with somebody from the Players Association a while ago. The salary structure of Major League Baseball is so odd, and it's a result of, you know, years of different court cases and collective bargaining agreements and stuff. If you started with a blank slate, I don't think you would ever arrive at anything like what we have right now. But, you know, we have this situation, and, you know, it works out well for players that stay in Major League Baseball a long time and are able to get to free agency. You know, it works out pretty well for people who make it to arbitration. And you know, the guys who are playing on the minimum contracts, you know, that's something like $500,000 too. So it's not the not the worst job you could have, but you know, you're kind of stuck with the system that you have, and so you're kind of constantly making tweaks to that, and it just makes it more complicated and more complicated, which I guess gives jobs to lawyers and you know, people like that. But it's certainly a strange scenario that we have right now.
For sure.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and start wrapping up. I know that this article was in the September 2016 issue of the Boston College Law Review. Since then, there's been a new CBA agreed to between the league and the players' union. Did that CBA address this issue?
So we actually we kind of rushed to get my note into the September 2016 edition because we wanted to have it there before any possible CBA could come out and when negotiations were starting. But of course, the new CBA did not address the issue. It addressed a lot of things, a lot of revenue sharing issues, drug testing rules, minimum salaries, along with new anti-bullying and smokeless tobacco rules. But it did not address service time. My best guess is that a lot of the things in CBA, like the minimum salaries, the anti-bullying, those kind of things were no-brainers. And the things that took a lot of negotiation were the revenue sharing, the new rules surrounding playing in other countries as well, the things that would make the MLB and the MLBPA money. And so these, they're kind of focusing on the things that impact revenue. And at this point, service time has yet to impact revenue. Although it's a bad PR move a lot of the time when these teams are manipulating service time, it ends up going away. And as you can see, Cubs fans are no longer upset about Chris Bryant's service time being manipulated because he won Rookie of the Year and then MVP and then they won the World Series. So my best guess is that they will eventually keep taking a look at it down the road, but I'm not sure that the system ever will change unless there's another situation like Chris Bryant's.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of, you know, there's always things popping up. There's a lot of things to negotiate, and you can only use so much of your leverage, and so you kind of got to pick and choose your battles. And I guess the Players Association decided this wasn't affecting enough people, or as you said, affecting revenue enough to be an issue. Okay, and do you have any updates about the actual arbitration case?
I wish I did. I have no idea. All these arbitration cases are kept completely secretive. So, like I said before, Chris Bryant filed the grievance after the 2015 season. The Phillies' Michael Franco actually also filed a grievance for service time manipulation at the same time, but we haven't seen anything in the news. Nothing has been released, and there obviously haven't been any lawsuits filed against the MLB by the MLBPA and Chris Bryant. So one of two things has happened. Either it's still going on, or the two sides have settled. In either case, we probably won't find out for a while.
Yeah, I mean, that it's crazy to imagine that they could have settled and the case is done, and just because it's a private arbitration, you don't hear anything for years. I've mentioned it before, but listeners to this podcast might be interested in another sports law podcast called Conduct Detrimental with Daniel Wallach and Dan Worley, and they just this week spoke with Nathaniel Groh from Fangraphs. And they talked about this issue too, and it's just an interesting situation, how this private arbitration works, and I guess we'll see down the road how it played out. But yeah, there hasn't even been any articles written about it for almost a year now, so it's kind of under the radar.
Yeah, and I actually in preparing to come talk to you today just looked to make sure that I hadn't been missing anything, and the last two articles that I saw were January 2016, and then, like you said, the Conduct Detrimental podcast that I think came out just within the last couple weeks or so.
So yeah, no, that's just an interesting aspect of U.S. law there. So, okay, well, do you have any final statements or, you know, something looking forward to on this topic going forward before we wrap up?
And the best I can say is hopefully this stays kind of in the front of sports lawyers and the sports law community's mind, because I think it is a real issue, even though we don't see kind of big impacts to teams or players like you'd see in the Deflategate issue or in steroid scandals or things in other leagues. This is something that does have the ability to impact players. And these are players whose careers aren't always very long and who can be financially harmed a lot by not being able to get to their salary arbitration or their free agency eligibility plateaus. So although it's kind of in and out depending on who it's happening to, it is a real problem, and hopefully we'll see a solution to it soon.
Okay, well, yeah, thanks for taking the time to come talk with us about this today. Pat Kisok is looking to be somebody to keep your eye on going forward, and I'm sure you have a bright future ahead of you. So yeah, thanks for speaking about this and for being on the Sports Lobbyist podcast.
Thanks a lot for having me, Peter.
This has been an episode of the Sports Law Biz podcast. This podcast is available through the Sports Law Biz website or through iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and YouTube. Before wrapping things up, I'd like to thank some people. First of all, I'd like to thank my friend, Lieb Montoya, for designing the Sports Law Biz podcast logo as well as the Sports Law Biz blog logo. His artistic ability certainly surpasses mine. If interested, you can check out more of Lieb's work on Instagram and Twitter. His handle is @LiebMontoya in both places. That's @LIB Montoya. Additionally, I'd like to thank the musical artist for providing this theme music that you're listening to right now. The artist is a band called The Losers. The album is entitled Young, Tough, Terrible. The track is Sports with an exclamation point. The label is Needle Drop Co. This music is available through a Creative Commons license of Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 Unported. This podcast was produced and recorded by myself, Peter Ott, and you can reach me at my personal Twitter handle, @PeterJOTT, through the Sports Law Biz Twitter handle, @SportsLawBiz, or through email at sportslawbizblog@gmail.com. Any feedback is greatly appreciated. If you are interested in contributing to either the Sports Law Biz blog or podcast, definitely reach out to me. I love to talk to people about these issues, and I know I can use all the help I can get. Finally, I'd like to thank you for listening to this podcast. Hopefully it was enjoyable. If so, please spread the word and let your friends and colleagues know about it. Leave a review on iTunes. Any way you can spread the news about this podcast would be greatly appreciated. That's our episode today. Tune in next time to learn more about the law and business of sports. Looking forward to discussing it with you on the Sports Law Biz podcast.